Interview with Paul Gonson by Kenneth Durr, July 12, 2006, at Kirkpatrick and Lockhart in Washington, D.C.
Well, thank you for agreeing to meet with me today. I want to start just with a little bit of quick background so we can get a sense of how you worked your way up into the solicitor's job at the commission.
Well, I came to the SEC in 1961. From private law practice in Buffalo, New York, and started the old division of corporate regulation, now called investment management, and did mostly bankruptcy reorganization work, which was an important part of the commission's work at that time, and found that many of the cases that I worked on were going up on appeal. So I was working with David Ferber, who then was SEC solicitor, and helping on the cases that I had handled in the lower court that were up on appeal, and argued some of those cases. And then there came a time when Dave Ferber asked if I would transfer to the general counsel's office and become primarily an appellate lawyer. Mm-hmm. And that was attractive to me, and I did that in, I think, 1967, more or less, and worked on many things, not just appellate work, but a great deal on appellate work. And then when Dave Ferber retired in 1979, then I took his job and became solicitor from 79 to 1988, when at the end of that year I retired from the SEC and then joined the firm of Kirkpatrick and Lockhart, where, of course, I still am today. So for that 20-year period, from 79 to 98, I was then in charge of the SEC's appellate practice and also its defense work and some other things. And that was, of course, the heyday of the cases that went to the courts, and particularly the Supreme Court in the insider trading area. Uh-huh. I had also worked very extensively with the Division of Enforcement on enforcement cases, generally speaking. But as the insider trading cases, or program as it was called, started to develop, in addition to my appellate work, I also worked with the division in formulating theories or principles that could be asserted in these cases. And even when cases went to trial in trial court, sometimes I worked with the trial lawyers with an eye toward developing a record that may end up in the appellate courts. So I tended to not only handle the appellate process, but also be involved in the formulation of policy. And that's sort of a little bit of the background.
Took us through the whole thing a little bit there. I'm interested to hear you talk about an insider trading program. So it sounds like rather than being reactive and responding to things that were coming up, there was actually an attempt to pursue this thing systematically.
Right.
When would that have begun?
Probably it would have started early, my guess is in the 70s, but really took traction in the early 80s, when the wave of tender offers and mergers started to occur. By a program, the SEC generally has a number of cases. I don't remember exactly what the figures are, but I think that it's probably safe to say that the SEC probably brings some 500 or so law enforcement cases every year, and perhaps of that amount, perhaps 10% or maybe 45 or 50 of them are insider trading cases. So it has a program in the sense that it focuses on a number of cases in the same category. It has a financial fraud program, for example. It'll have program relating to false filing of documents, etc. So the insider trading program was a program that was developed to try to stop what was considered abusive trading based on insider information. And the program was interesting because the SEC would not only go after the really big cases, and of course it would, but it would also make sure that it brought a few small cases. It would like everyone to know that, as we used to say, we being we when I was at the SEC, that you can't fly under the radar screen. That is, don't try it even with just a little bit of training, because we're going to try to catch you also. Otherwise, people say, well, if I trade small, I probably won't be detected. And maybe there's some merit in that in the stock watch systems. But so the SEC generally would bring the bigger cases, but it would also make sure that it brings some smaller cases as well. And it would bring them in a variety of areas as well, to sort of make its presence felt, generally speaking, in different areas of insider trading, which I'll get to.
So enforcement would have been monitoring this overall insider trading program?
Yes, it would be handled by the Division of Enforcement.
Was there someone within that division who would have special, that would be their area?
Well, there were some people who I think were prominent in that area. Gary Lynch was the director of enforcement. My recollection is, I don't have the exact dates now, but in the 1980s, when John Shadd was SEC chairman, Chairman Shadd was chairman of the Reagan administration, and he pushed forward a very vigorous insider trading program. As a matter of fact, he had a phrase that he was going to stomp down with hobnail boots on insider trading. And one of the principal deputies was John Sturck, S-T-U-R-C. It was a former prosecutor, very, very capable guy who handled a lot of these cases. Barry Goldsmith, who was then head of the trial unit, later went to the NASD, now is in a private law firm just recently, was very active in that area. Tom Newkirk, who was Goldsmith's predecessor as head of the trial unit, very active in that area. When Gary Lynch left, Bill McLucas became director, and he continued their program. I think the SEC was fortunate in having such very really capable and dedicated people to run their program.
Well, I think we'll get into a lot of those specifics, but let's go back a little bit and talk about, if you can remember, your earlier involvement with insider trading. The first case, or the first significant case, and I'd like to get a sense of the legacy of the 60s cases, Katie Roberts, Texas Gulf Sulphur, and what the context was for your early insider trading deals.
I think maybe a little historical background will explain, you know, Katie Roberts and Texas Gulf Sulphur. That's very good. Those are very good questions. Those were the first two cases. Insider trading is not defined in the federal securities laws. That is, you can't look it up in a statute or rule and get a definition of it, and nor is it made unlawful in express terms anywhere in the law. So that when one wants to learn about insider trading, one really has to read the cases that developed case by case, and that's still true today. Even after all these years and all these cases and several congressional attempts, there is still no definition of insider trading even today. Rather, it is a species of fraud, mostly under the famous Section 10B and Rule 10B-5 under the Securities Exchange Act. So that act says that it shall be unlawful to engage in manipulative or deceptive devices or contrivances in contravention of rules the SEC will promulgate in the public interest in connection with the purchase or sale of a security. You really can't tell very much from that language what it means. So that language, which has been upheld, is not void for vagueness, a doctrine that says if it's too, sometimes language is too void, it just doesn't work. That has been upheld, and based on that language, you need either a manipulation or a deception, in connection with the purchase or sale of a security. So those are the key words that are used. And the first case that you referred to, which was Katie Roberts, was a case in 1961 that was brought, this was before my time there, which was an administrative proceeding as distinguished from a court case that is brought by the SEC within its own, with its own building, so to speak, before an administrative law judge. And that case established a ground rule that said that business information was intended for business use and not the personal use of an individual. And when an individual used it for his personal use, it was an unfair use. I'm obviously glossing over much more technical language. But that, so far as I'm aware, was the very first time that the SEC articulated a theory of insider trading. And
is this where we get the fiduciary responsibility idea?
It starts there. It really develops a little later in the Chiarella case, which I will get to. The fiduciary duty case comes a little later. The Texas Gulf Sulphur case was around 1965-66 in federal court in New York City. That was the first case in which the SEC went to court as distinguished from an administrative proceeding before an administrative law judge, and then sought an injunction in disgorgement of insider trading profits, which means you have to give the money back. It also asked for disgorgement of tippees' profits, that is, persons who were tipped. It had to be made by the tippers, which is an interesting concept. That case hit corporate America like a tidal wave, because many directors of big corporations believed that one of the perquisites of being a director of a company was that you did get insider information, you know, and you were able to trade on it. And here now the SEC is saying, no, you can't do that. And that was an enormous, I was at the SEC at that time, that was an enormous blow to corporate America. As a matter of fact, in those days, there were some people who were directors of dozens of companies. And obviously, a person who's director of dozens of companies can't devote sufficient time as a director of particular companies, so many times one thought the reason they were in so many companies was simply to get inside information to make trading profits. So that was a bombshell of a case. The facts of that case were really quite interesting. There, Texas Gulf Sulphur, which is a mineral company, made a tremendous ore strike or mineral strike in Timmins, Ontario, a rural area up in Canada. And it wanted to keep secret that oil strike or mineral strike, understandably, because it wanted to go to the farmers in the immediate area of that strike and buy up some more land. And of course, if it revealed the ore strike, why the price of that adjoining land would, of course, zoom up in value.
Right.
So there was a legitimate business purpose to keep that secret. But many of the executives of Texas Gulf Sulphur bought stock, knowing that eventually when that information would come out, why the price of the stock would zoom up, which it did, and tipped others who also bought stock. So the SEC brought action against all of these people in district court, and it was a novel case. It was tried by Frank Kennemer, who was, in those days, there was not yet a division of enforcement, by the way, which did not occur until the early 70s. And the SEC's general counsel's office, which I was a part of, generally handled the trials of major cases.
Did you know Frank Kennemer?
Oh, very well, yeah. He was called the old gray fox. He was an older man. I suppose today I'm an older man, but in those days I was a young man. So anybody with gray hair was an old man to me. And he was a very, very fine trial lawyer, and tried the case successfully and won it. And the court held that there was a violation of the securities laws. The case then went to the Second Circuit on appeal. That's the Federal Appeals Court in New York City, which affirmed in a very important opinion. And the court there said that to the extent possible, people in the market should have relatively equal access to the same information. This became known as an equal access theory, and I'll get to this later, which at some later point the Supreme Court rejected in favor of looking for fiduciary duties, which you had mentioned a moment ago. But this relatively equal access of all participants in the market was one of the landmarks of the Texas Gulf Sulphur decision in the Second Circuit. The Second Circuit also developed what was became known as the disclose or abstain rule. That is, that if you have this kind of information, you have to disclose it so that the other side of the trade in the market will have the same information you have, that is, gives effect to this relatively equal access theory. Mm-hmm. And if you don't disclose it or you cannot disclose it, then you have to abstain, that is, you cannot trade. And because many companies have business policies which prevent officials from disclosing business information, that abstain or disclose rule really means an abstain rule. And in Texas Gulf Sulphur, it certainly would have meant that rule. It would have meant that in that case. Mm-hmm. Let me just go back, if I can, to give some sort of a general background.
Sure.
So that when we get to some of the specific cases, I think they'll be perhaps better understood. There is a famous Supreme Court case that says that there's no such thing as federal common law. This is a case called Erie versus Tompkins in 1938. And by that it means that while in England, prior to this country becoming a nation, there was a system of common law where courts would develop the law case by case by case. In the federal system, that's true in state courts today, where state courts inherit that traditional British system. But in federal courts are considered to be, under the U.S. Constitution, courts of limited jurisdiction, and they have only such jurisdiction as Congress gives them. So they're not supposed to develop case by case, although up to 1938 they certainly did. So when we speak of case by case development in insider trading, we're strictly, maybe I'm being a purist, not talking about a common law development. It's not sort of like it. Really what it is a statutory interpretation. Courts are construing the words manipulative and deceptive in connection with the purchase and sale of the security under Section 10B and Rule 10B-5. And materiality, it has to be material, it has to be non-public. Those are the words that courts are construing. But they are nonetheless construing it case by case by case by case. There are several theories which I'll get to in a minute. If you have a system of developing something on a non-statutory basis, you have to have some theory of law for it, because the statute doesn't give you that principle. And when one realizes that the SEC was created in 1934, and the statute that we're talking about is in an act promulgated in 1934, these developments don't occur until the 60s. So for the first 30 years, there was not really an insider trading program of the kind that we're talking about. So one might say, well, why did it take 30 years to develop? Or putting in another reason, why did it develop at all when it had not developed before? And my own view is that it is a cultural phenomenon. That is, that society reaches a point where it starts to believe that there's a fundamental unfairness for some people who are in the know and who have access to inside information to trade on it when others in the market don't have that information. And so I think that there was a feeling that there had to be some kind of development of the law that would deal with that phenomenon. or like playing, you wouldn't play poker in a rigged game,
right?
Because you know that the cards were stacked against you, and I guess it's a little bit of that. So the first theory that was developed, which
can we,
sure,
while we're talking about antecedents,
mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about the 34 Act had another section that dealt specifically with insiders, people who own 10% of a company.
Right, right. That's a very good question, Ken. That's section 16B of the 1934 Act, and that was one of the original sections in the Act in 1934. And that section is sort of a crude rule of thumb. It says that any person who is an officer or director of a public company or has 10% or more of the stock of that company, if that person buys and sells or sells and buys within a 6-month period, then the person is liable to a forfeiture or paying back the profits on that transaction. The SEC is given no role in that other than making rules, but the process by which the profit would be recaptured for the company is given to the company itself in another section. And indeed, there have been many lawsuits seeking to recapture those profits, trading profits. Over the years, the SEC has promulgated very elaborate rules on, you know, how the section works and when it works. The Supreme Court has decided a number of cases which is pretty construed very narrowly. And is what I call it, a rule of thumb, is probably as crude as a thumb, because it doesn't presuppose that you don't have to show fraud or you don't have to show any illegality. Indeed, the section does not make this conduct illegal. It simply provides a mechanism for recovery of the profits. I might also say that there are state law analogs in Delaware and in New York State, very famous cases, which in effect do the same thing, which say that under state law, or state fiduciary duty law, that corporations can then recover trading profits from insiders who trade very similarly to this.
Why wouldn't 16B be something, why would that have been appropriate to a case like Texas Gulf Software?
Well, I guess 16B would have eventually, assuming that they bought and sold within a 6-month period, and they did, it probably would have applied. But it has its limitations in that it doesn't make the conduct unlawful, whereas Section 10B starts with, it shall be unlawful to, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So when one seeks to then impose other sanctions for insider trading, one has to go to a different kind of theory. And there are, you know, a lot of draconian results or sanctions as a result of insider trading. Maybe I'm jumping ahead, but in addition to giving the money back, which is called disgorgement, there's also a statute called the Insider Trading Sanctions Act that allows the SEC to request up to 3 times the profit obtained or the loss avoided as a penalty, and courts often do impose that. And the reason for that statute was, it was felt that simply, you know, if we catch you with your hands in the cookie jar, you got to put the cookies back, is not enough of a deterrent. And so this 3 times penalty, up to 3 times penalty, was considered an additional deterrent. Also, as we'll talk, many of these cases were brought as criminal cases because there's another statute, Section 32 of the 34 Act, which criminalizes any kind of, most of the conduct which is illegal under the 34 Act. And so if you can meet the criminal law standards, which are a higher degree of intent, seriousness, why the case can be brought as a criminal case. And indeed, of the 4 cases that went to the Supreme Court, which are Chiarella, Dirks, Carpenter, and O'Hagan, 3 of the 4 of them were criminal cases. So while my guess is, it's just a guess, that of the 45 or 50 cases a year that the SEC brings in its insider trading program, my guess is about 10% of those are criminal cases. Yet, the blockbuster cases tended to be brought in a criminal forum. And in addition, there could be an injunction against future violations. If the injunction is against a person who is a regulatee of the SEC, or maybe a corporate director or a lawyer, that can have severe collateral consequences. One is enjoined for illegal conduct. And there could be an officer or a director bar. A person can be barred from ever being an officer or director of a company again. So a lot of consequences that can ensue as a result of bringing insider trading as a species of fraud, as distinguished from 16B, which, as I say, merely allows the company to sue to recapture the trading profits.
So the question becomes, how to define that fraud?
It does, yes. There's really a question of definition. And I would have to say that the SEC has been aggressive in developing these theories and pushing the envelope, as a cliche goes, and case by case by case, so sort of ever broadening the reach of its insider trading program, which gets me back again to the criminal cases that I mentioned. The American Bar Association had a committee some years ago that was critical of the SEC bringing leading edge theory cases in the criminal forum. There was nothing wrong, legally speaking, the SEC certainly could do that if it wished, or U.S. attorneys could, but it was felt that as a matter of policy, if you were going to test a new theory, that new theory should be tested in a civil case, where if the person loses, the person may have to give money back or pay a penalty, but not in a criminal case where if the person loses, he may have to go to jail. It was this question of unfairness. The SEC, however, has nonetheless continued to bring many of these cases, and still does, in a criminal forum, and in more recent years, generally speaking, has stepped up its criminal enforcement, as you probably are aware, not only in insider trading, but of course in other areas of the law as well. So, undeterred, they're still bringing leading-edge cases in the criminal context.
Well, can we move into some of those cases that you mentioned? Chiarella, you would have gone into the solicitor's position in time to have handled that.
Yes.
And you were dealing at this point with equal access theory, coming in to the appellate process on Chiarella.
Right. The Chiarella case was the first insider trading case to reach the Supreme Court. And it has an interesting history. The SEC had brought a bunch of cases against financial printers in the late 1970s because there were people in those printing companies who were sending type. They were called markup men, I think, in those days. That was the day of actual typesetting. And they were preparing documents that were going to be filed with the SEC, like tender offer documents, within just a matter of a day or two, actually. And these printing companies took great special pains to make sure that the information was kept secret. They would have signs all over the buildings. They would have signs on the pay slips that they would give to their people, and took great efforts to keep it secret. Indeed, I think that even for the most part, the names of the companies who were targets of these takeovers were coded or omitted so that one would not know when one was typing who the company was. Well, the SEC brought a number of cases against financial printers and settled every one of those, including Chiarella. Chiarella then was working for Pandic Press, a financial printer, and Chiarella had set type, and he was a pretty savvy guy and was able, by reading the document in its entirety and his knowledge of the market generally, to be able to tell the name of these companies, even though the company's name was not included in the material. And what he did was he bought shares in the companies who were takeover targets shortly before these documents were filed and the takeover was made public. And then afterwards, of course, the price of the target stock would rise and he'd sell and he'd make a profit. He made around $30,000, and he paid that money back in a civil settlement to the SEC. Unbeknownst to the SEC, an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York heard about or read about this case and sought an indictment of Chiarella, criminal indictment, and prosecuted Chiarella to a conviction. At least unbeknownst to me, and I think unbeknownst to SEC people. The case then went to the Second Circuit on appeal, and by that time, around that time, I became aware of the case. The Second Circuit affirmed the case essentially on an equal access theory. It said that the Chiarella was sort of in the center of the business. I mean, he was getting all this insider information and talked about the relatively equal access theory of the Texas Gulf Sulphur case and some of the cases that have occurred since that time. And on that theory, affirmed the conviction of Chiarella. Also, in the Second Circuit, but not in the district court, not in the criminal court, the Second Circuit also talked about a theory which later became known as the misappropriation theory. That is, that he had stolen the information or misappropriated the information that was entrusted to his employer for this specific secret purpose. We have to also understand that, as we talked about the Chiarella case, that this is what's called a silence case as distinguished from a misstatement case. So when we talk about Rule Section 10B and Rule 10B-5 or fraud generally, there are two kinds. One is an affirmative misrepresentation or misstatement, and then there is another species of fraud, which is you don't say anything at all. And if you don't say anything at all, and you know something, the other guy doesn't know something, and you're doing business with him, have you cheated him? Is that a fraud? And generally speaking, here we get back to the common law of England, and which came down to the United States. And generally speaking, there was a doctrine called caveat emptor, which meant let the buyer beware. And generally speaking, there was no duty to speak. You didn't. In other words, if you had some information, you didn't. There was no legal obligation for you to tell the other guy when you were negotiating that information. Now, there were some exceptions. Let's say you had stolen the information and the other person couldn't get that information by diligence or by industry. He'd have to steal it too. Well, perhaps under that circumstance, you'd have to tell him. Or if you were a fiduciary, you had some obligation to that person, some duty. If you're trading, maybe you'd have to tell him. But, and so this background of common law influences this Chiarella decision because where there is no statute saying what the duties are or what the definition of insider trading is, you have to look to some source to find whether there's some obligation to speak. And then this was referred to in the common law as the tort of deceit. And there is a very illustrious group in the United States called the American Law Institute, which has many books in which they tend to restate the law, as they call it. They're called restatements of the law. And there's a restatement of the law of torts that deals with the law of deceit. And if you look up there, you'll see all kinds of examples of these so-called silence cases, which came out of the common law. But those were almost always cases where there were face-to-face dealings. But here, we were dealing now on an impersonal stock market. So, and there was no inducement on the other side to come in. Some of these fraud cases, if they're misrepresentation cases, are where one person induces the other to trade based on a false statement. But on the other side of the trade, of Chiarella's trades, all these people were coming into the stock market based on nothing Chiarella was doing to them. They were coming in to sell stock for to pay their kids' college tuition or take a vacation or buy a house or whatever. So the notion that there was some relationship between Fiorella's trade and their trades is really absent in the sense that there's no inducement. So then the question arises, well, what is the theory under which Fiorella should be liable for insider trading to these persons whom he has no idea who they are in an impersonal stock market transaction? So the Supreme Court says that with regard to the theory that the first theory that the Second Circuit used, which is a relative equal access theory, rejects that theory. Says there is no theory of law that would provide under fraud equal access to information.
And this is, you argued this case?
No, I did not. This case was argued by Steve Schoen. This was a criminal case.
Okay.
Criminal cases were in those days, and still today, generally argued by either the Solicitor General or senior people in the Solicitor General's office. So Steve Shapiro argued the case, but I assisted him in the case and sort of oversaw the writing of the brief for the United States.
Was your brief then was based on this equal access theory?
Our brief was based generally on two theories. One was the equal access theory, which was, of course, the theory under which Fiorella was convicted. There was a second theory, as I mentioned a moment ago, in the Court of Appeals decision called what we later became known as the misappropriation theory.
Okay.
And this misappropriation theory was a theory that said that if somebody steals information or takes information to which he's been entrusted and then trades on it, then he breaches his duty to the source of the information. Now, here's where we get into sort of complications of the theories. Before I continue on Fiorella, let me back up into what's called the classical theory of insider trading. Do you remember that years ago there used to be something called classic Coke or Coke, and then it became, then they had a new Coke, and the new Coke bombed, and they decided to call the old Coke classic Coke. So the first theory was never called the classic theory until there was a second theory. The first theory was simply the theory of insider trading. The theory of insider trading, as exemplified in the Katie Roberts SEC opinion and the Texas Gulf Sulphur Second Circuit opinion, was essentially that officers and directors of corporations have fiduciary duties not to disadvantage their shareholders. And this comes from state law, common law, state law. And that theory applies certainly when the insider is trading with the shareholder. So when the insider is buying stock on the stock market, necessarily he's buying from a shareholder. The theory loses substance when the insider is selling, because when the insider sells on bad news, let's say there's bad news insider trading cases, the person he sells to is not a shareholder, but he becomes a shareholder by virtue of that very transaction. So there was another case in the Second Circuit, very famous case by Judge Learned Hand, the famous Second Circuit judge, that applied that same doctrine to insiders when they sell as when they buy, and sort of made it equivalent. So there grew up this doctrine of fiduciary duty not to disadvantage shareholders or would-be shareholders in transactions with them. And that theory first was used with regard to officers and directors who have well-established fiduciary duties. Eventually, the SEC in cases extended that theory to anybody in the company, even persons who would be of a lower level, on the theory that they were insiders of the company. So then when the trade was made without disclosing the information the insider had, that, of course, was a violation then of the fiduciary duty. because you would then disadvantage the shareholder by not putting that person on the same informational plane that you had. And that was the theory later called the classical theory. And that theory was pretty good. It was a pretty good theory. And for the most part, it reached most of the cases, because most of the cases where officials were trading in their own stock. And that made sense. Then there came a time, and I'll get back to Chiro, but this is sort of a background to it. There came a time when takeovers became very prominent in this country. This led to a law called the Williams Act in 1968, and then amended again in 1970, and this act gave the SEC authority to regulate tender offers and to pass rules governing the regulation. Around the same time, standardized options trading started to become okay in the U.S. Years earlier, if you wanted to buy options on stock, you had to go to something called a put and call dealer and get an option, but there was no formal standardized options sold on exchanges. So the Chicago Board Options Exchange, called the CBOE, around that time came into effect, and very gradually other exchanges started to deal in options. So it became possible to control a large amount of stock with only a small dollar investment. As you know, margin requirements in this country for years have been 50%. So if you want to buy $10,000 worth of stock, you have to put down $5,000 in dollars. But if you buy options on those stocks, thinking the stock's going to go up, well, you can buy an option, pay a premium for a much slower amount. So the same $5,000 that would get you $10,000 in stock, if you bought in premiums, it gets you, a huge amount of control over stock.
Right.
So the marriage, or the fortuitous combination of people who started to know about upcoming tender offers and who were then able to buy options on the stock of the target company, fueled a tremendous boom, if you want to put it that way, in insider trading. But the classical theory, which says that the fiduciary officer and director can't trade in his own company stock, wouldn't apply, because you weren't trading in your company stock, you were trading in a target company stock with whom you had no relationship at all. So how are you going to reach that kind of trading? So the misappropriation theory was a device that said, well, if you were working in a brokerage firm and handling mergers and acquisitions, and you got some information about upcoming tender offers, and you traded yourself, or you passed it on to cronies and they traded, why, then you were entrusted with information and you had misappropriated that information. And so that theory was developed to try to reach that kind of phenomenon. And there were arbitrageurs like the famous Ivan Boesky, who would, of course, want to know tips about these upcoming tender offers, because they would want to take positions in them. And it would be to the advantage of the bidder, prospective bidder, to put stock in friendly hands, because
right.
At some point he's going to make an offer and he would like then to have the stock in friendly hands to be tendered into his offer. The arbitrageur would want to be in that position, because the price of the tender offer price would almost always be higher than the market price, and the profit was pretty well assured. So the symbiotic relationship led to many examples of persons who were tipping and trading. So there were two things that developed. One was the sort of creation of this misappropriation theory, and the other was a rule that the SEC promulgated called Rule 14E3 under the Williams Act. Section 14E is sort of an anti-fraud section similar to 10B, except it relates to tender offers only. And then there's a provision added in 1970 that allows the SEC to pass rules not only to define fraud in tender offers, but also rules to prevent fraud from occurring in the first place, means to prevent the fraud from occurring. So the SEC promulgated a rule under this section 14E, which it called 14E3, in which it said that if a person obtains information about an upcoming tender offer from a source connected either with the bidder or the target and then trades on it, then that person violates that rule, directed specifically toward tender offers. And there is an exception for the bidder himself, who, of course, can buy stock and is not obviously subject to that rule. But it was intended to reach what was sometimes called warehousing, where stock was tipped and then put in friendly hands while a tender offer was going on. So the two theories, the misappropriation theory and the Rule 14E3, were twin attempts to deal with this phenomenon.
So misappropriation came about before GRL.
The theory was being sort of nosed around before Chiarella, and it was pursued, but in the Chiarella case, what happened was, on the merits, before we get to misappropriation, in the majority opinion, the court says that Chiarella was not an insider. That is, under the traditional theory, he wasn't an officer director of the company in which he traded. These were all other companies. He was a stranger to those companies. He owed no duty to anybody in the marketplace to tell them about it. And consequently, he didn't violate the law. And then the government had, in its brief, pushed hard this misappropriation theory. So Justice Powell, writing for a majority of the court, said, well, we can't reach the misappropriation theory because the misappropriation theory in this criminal case was not presented to the jury. And we can only reach theories that were presented to the jury. And I digress to give a little lecture on appellate procedure. In criminal cases, which must be tried under a beyond a reasonable doubt standard of proof, there's no such thing as a directed verdict. That is, a court can't say to the jury, well, you have to find for the government or find for the defendant. When there is a conviction and the conviction goes up on appeal, the court can only look at the jury instructions. That is, what was the jury told? What was the jury at? What was the theory under which the government prosecuted? In this case, the government had not prosecuted under the theory, under a misappropriation theory, and so the court said, well, majority said we're not going to reach this case. But interestingly, we're not going to reach this theory. But interestingly, there were a number of dissenting and concurring opinions that said, I think the theory is pretty good. So Justice Stevens concurred in the view that there was no liability, but he thought the misappropriation theory has some merit to it. Justice Brennan concurred only on the inadequate jury charge, but he too thought that the misappropriation theory has some merit. Chief Justice Berger at that time dissented. He thought, in fact, it had been well presented to the jury, but he said in any event, he said that when a person trades on the basis of undisclosed information, quote, obtained not by superior experience, foresight, or industry, but by some unlawful means, then he does have an obligation to tell the other side of the trade. And he also had a theory that there was a duty to the marketplace, which was never subsequently adopted by any other court. And Justice Blackmun, joined by Justice Marshall, dissented. They would have affirmed the case on the theory that was presented, and they too thought that the misappropriation theory wasn't a very bad theory at all. So here you had four and a half concurring or dissenting opinions giving some validity to this theory, even though the court doesn't accept it. And it's one of these kind of cases where the SEC or the government loses, on the other hand, you know, gets a win indirectly because the court suggests that this theory has some validity.
Right.
So the next case that's brought is a case called U.S. versus Newman, which is in the Second Circuit. And there, Newman is a stockbroker, and he has friends who are with several big investment bankers. And these investment bankers are tipping Newman about upcoming tender offers.
Can we, just looking at Chiarella then, you were working with Steve Shapiro, who was arguing this case. You got, and you argued it in front of the Supreme Court, and then you hear, you get this message from the court. At this point, did you actually sit down, look through everything, and say, aha, they want us to go here, or this is an opportunity, misappropriation is an opportunity?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, at that time, there was a young lawyer named Donald Langevoort, L-A-N-G-E-V-O-O-R-T, who was working in the general counsel's office, and we dispatched him to New York to work with the United States attorney in drafting an indictment based on this theory in what later became the Newman case.
Okay.
So it was a very carefully orchestrated effort to capitalize
on
this.
The Newman case didn't just happen.
No. The Newman case was created in the wake of the Chiarella case. As a matter of fact, Langevoort, since that time, became a very famous law professor. Now is at Georgetown Law School, was at Vanderbilt for years, and is the author of probably the best well-known treatise on insider trading, which I have in my office. Just recently now in two volumes. And but his early start really was helping the United States Attorney in New York draft the indictment in the Newman case so it would pass muster, because we knew that would be the test case, the first big test case out of the box after Chiarella, which indeed it was.
So the SEC at this point then is actually working with the U.S. With the Justice Department,
right? Prosecutor in New York.
To bring just the right charges.
Right. Right. In the right kind of a case, of course. You have to have the right kind of. This was a good case. These were two fellows from different brokerage firms who were, in effect, stealing information from their brokerage firms about upcoming tender offers and passing it on to a coterie of people. Newman was a stockbroker in the case. And they were buying. They're very much like Chiarella was, really. They were buying stock and then selling it after the tender offers were announced and making a profit. And in the district court, Judge Haight, H-A-H-A-I-G-H-T, in the Southern District, dismissed the indictment as a matter of law. He said it was insufficient. And the Second Circuit reinstated it and said, well, you know, this is our day. The Supreme Court left open the question of misappropriation. Now we reach it for the very first time, and we hold that that is a good theory, and that under that basis, Mr. Newman can be prosecuted. He then was prosecuted, and he was sent to jail, and he did appeal to the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court denied cert, did not take his case. So I do remember that when later when Dirks was argued, Newman and his lawyer were in the audience listening to the argument. Anyway.
Why did the Supreme Court have denied it?
Well, probably because the issue wasn't, quote, well percolated. The Supreme Court has this, and of course we opposed cert in Newman, as we do in all cases generally in which we won below, we again being the government. And generally speaking, it isn't always true, but sometimes when a new theory is developed, the Supreme Court would like to have a number of lower federal appeals courts deal with it and develop it. And sometimes they use the phrase percolation, like coffee percolates, right. Like it percolated in the lower courts before it's sort of ripe for review. My guess is that's why. Also, I have to say that this was used several times. Newman was also convicted for mail fraud and wire fraud, as well as for securities fraud. It's very hard to go to the Supreme Court and test a securities fraud case when you have a mail fraud conviction, which is hard to overturn. So as a practical matter, the Supreme Court, I'm guessing now, it's just speculation, might say, well, why should we take a case and maybe reverse, you know, a securities part of it when there's a mail fraud part of it? That's, you know, the guy's going to go to jail anyway. So maybe that was part of it. I don't know. I'm just guessing at that.
So misappropriation worked itself through the circuit courts. And I guess at this point, are you a solicitor then for the SEC?
Yes, I was solicitor for the SEC at that point.
And what was your most notable case of coming in early at this point?
Well, the... A notable case? You mean in this kind?
Yeah, a notable insider trading case that you dealt
with. Well, gosh, there were so many of them. It's hard to say. There were a number of cases that were brought again on the misappropriation theory in other courts. There was a case Clark in the Ninth Circuit that I argued. Trying to remember the name of the case in the Seventh Circuit that Jake Stillman argued, but I had worked on with him, which were all varieties of the same thing. The SEC was trying to establish in other circuits the validity of the misappropriation theory, and indeed we did. In the Seventh Circuit case, his name escapes me for a moment, which will come to me, I'm sure, the person had worked for a large investment bank and then was fired, I guess, or left. But he managed to persuade the personnel department to allow him to keep his access card to the building. And then what he would do is he would come in the dead of night by using his access card, and he'd ruffle through everybody's inbox to try to get information about upcoming deals, which he did, and then he would trade on these deals. And I guess he was pretty smart in some respects, but wasn't smart enough to realize that he was leaving an electronic record every time he pushed his card in that recorded the fact that he'd come into the building. So it wasn't very hard to catch him. The Seventh Circuit adopted the misappropriation theory. Clark was a case that I'd argued where the court also adopted in the Ninth Circuit, that's the Appeals Court for the West Coast, United States, they adapted the misappropriation theory. Also adapted theory is really interesting in that case. The SEC had also sued the broker who was a tippee of the insider. And the broker was found not to have violated the law. It was exonerated by the jury in that case, although the insider was not. And we had asked that the insider pay back the broker's profits. And he said, well, why should I pay the broker's profits when the jury found the broker didn't violate the law? But the court said you got to pay it anyway, and the Ninth Circuit affirmed that. So, yeah, you got to pay back the broker's profits. So it was a pretty vigorous program, and we were attempting to establish this theory, misappropriation theory, elsewhere. And these are some of the cases that went to the appeals courts, but there were many cases in lower courts that were brought, many of them were settled under the same theory. The cases, which are very famous cases against Siegel, Dennis Levine, Ivan Boesky, Michael Milken, these cases were all based on misappropriation theory. So misappropriation became a very important theory in which to proceed on the SEC's insider trading program.
While we're talking about tippees, were you involved with the Dirks case?
Yes, I was. Dirks was a case that was decided in 1983. Dirks was really a very interesting case. I had argued that case in the Supreme Court. And the New York Times wrote a big article about the oral argument, and it started by saying it was great theater, which it was. It was a really interesting case. Dirks was a very well-known analyst in the insurance industry. And there was a company called Equity Funding Corporation of America, which was a darling of Wall Street. A high-flying company that was very, very successful. And what it was doing was it was selling a combination of life insurance and mutual funds. And a mid-level executive or former executive of this company, Equity Funding, came to Dirks and said to Dirks, this entire operation is a fraud. And this was inherently unbelievable. It would be like somebody coming to an analyst who follows automobile companies and says, Chrysler doesn't put engines in their automobiles, they use big rubber bands or something like that. I mean, you know, if, to show you, you know, I would have thrown the guy out of my office if he had come to see me and tell me that. But Dirks, being sort of a tenacious guy, a little idiosyncratic guy, decides he's going to investigate this. So he, at his own time and expense, picks up and he goes to Los Angeles, where Equity Funding is located, and he interviews people and talks to people and makes an investigation. And sure enough, he concludes that this guy Sechrist was right. The thing is a giant fraud. As a matter of fact, what they would have, they would do, is that in the dead of night, Equity Funding would have what they would call parties, where they would create fictitious people that they would issue insurance policies on, and occasionally they would kill off these fictitious people and collect on the proceeds, and they would even reinsure by selling these policies, which were completely phony, to reinsurance companies and getting, you know, some part of the premiums for it. And this was an elaborate fraud, which
you
Dirks
used to be for a minute ago.
Yeah.
You said his last name. Who was that? Sechrist
was the tipper.
The tipper, you're right.
Tipper. He was the one. He was the mid-level executive or former executive from Equity Funding who spilled the beans. Sechrist, I don't remember it, but I have the opinion here. I could probably find it.
That's okay.
I don't remember his first name. And it was, and to some extent, Dirks was a folk hero, really. The SEC earlier had taken a look at the company and on some tip that something was wrong, didn't find anything. And even during that time when Dirks was now persuaded that it was a fraud, Dirks went to the Los Angeles office of the Wall Street Journal and urged them to write a story disclosing this fraud, exposing the fraud. And he spoke to a reporter who was very interested in it, but felt that it was too much of a risk for the journal to do this because they would expose themselves to libel laws unless they had a more solid basis. So the journal started to make its own investigation. Later on, I must say, they did write a tremendous story, and the guy who wrote it, I think, was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. But in any event, while Dirks is doing this, he has clients who hold Equity Funding securities. Now he knows that the whole thing is a huge fraud. And at some point, that's going to be exposed. And he's trying to expose it, but he's not successful doing it. So he tells his clients that they better get rid of their securities, because when this all comes out, boom, the securities are going to hit the floor. And they do. And I forgot the figure now, but there were, you know, quite a few million dollars worth of securities that were then sold. So eventually the SEC, when this all becomes known, the SEC immediately steps in, the company goes in receivership, a lot of these officials go to jail. And the question is, well, what do we do with Dirks? Because Dirks is both a hero in the sense that he exposes the fraud, and on the other hand, he tips his clients to get out of their securities before everything is known. So the SEC, and I was there at the time, agonizes over what to do about it.
Tell me about that process. Are you sitting in meetings, talking back and forth, taking different positions?
Well, the SEC's New York office was the one that investigated this. And the head of that office was a fellow named Donald Miloski. And the guy who was actually working the case was Roger Dietz. And they finally came with a recommendation, that is the New York office, to the SEC commissioners, that the SEC commissioners bring an administrative proceeding, an in-house proceeding, against Dirks, who of course is a registrant, he's a registered stockbroker, or associated with a stockbroker, to sanction him for insider trading. And the commissioners, of course, are agonizing about this. Well, should we do it or shouldn't we do it? Because this is a guy who exposed the fraud. On the other hand, he probably shouldn't have done what he did, which was to tip off his clients. And so they finally agreed to go ahead with the proceeding, but they imposed the least possible sanction, which is a reprimand. That is, they don't throw him out of the business, they don't suspend him, they don't fine him. They simply put a bad letter in his file. Now, Dirks is a man of, you know, great self-esteem and wants to vindicate his name. And even with a reprimand, he then appeals to the Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia Circuit. And the D.C. Circuit comes out with this very unusual kind of an opinion in which they affirm the SEC. But they do it in a very odd way. That is, one judge, Judge Wright, I recall, later writes an opinion in which no one else joins. And then another judge concurs but does not write an opinion. And a third judge dissents but does not write an opinion dissenting. So you have a one-judge opinion and another judge agreeing or concurring, making a 2-to-1 affirmance. Then Dirks appeals to the Supreme Court. The SEC opposes it, but the Supreme Court then takes the case. So the case goes to the Supreme Court, and the SEC's theory is a pretty simple theory, which was, went something like this. Sechrist himself obviously was an insider. Sechrist could not himself have sold equity funding securities. He would have violated what you'd call the classical theory, right? He would have disadvantaged whoever was on the other side of the trade. And so we said that when he tipped Dirks, Dirks stood in his shoes. Or putting it another way, Dirks inherited his disability. So whatever disability Sechrist had, he conveys it to whoever he tips. The Supreme Court rejected that line of argument. The Supreme Court said that Dirks, that Sechrist, was trying to expose the fraud. He wasn't doing anything wrong, and that tippy liability is derivative. That is, a tipper is liable only if a tippee, excuse me, is liable only if the tipper is liable. So you have to look to see whether the tipper has done something wrong. And if the tipper is getting paid by the tippee for the information, or is getting a quid pro quo, some monetary benefit, why, yeah, he's probably done something wrong. Or if the tipper is getting some reputational benefit, or some benefit, even if by giving information to a friend, that might be considered a benefit to the tipper. So what grew out of that was the so-called benefit test. That is, there could not be tippy liability unless you could show that the tipper somehow benefits from the tip in some way. And some are obvious, obviously. If he gets paid or there's a, you know, financial quid pro quo, there's certainly a benefit. But there can be so-called intangible benefits that could result from that. So the Dirks case was very interesting in the sense that it resulted in this first, again, rejection of an equal access theory. The court refers to his opinion in Chiarella. It again rejects the notion of equal access. There was also, it's also notable because there was a disagreement with the Solicitor General in this case. In every court except the Supreme Court, the SEC goes to court with its own lawyers and does not need the approval of the Solicitor General or anybody else in the government. However, when the case is in the Supreme Court, the SEC does need the approval of the Solicitor General. The Solicitor General took the position, the Solicitor General was Rex Lee, by the way. The Solicitor General took the position that there should be an encouragement of what he called private law enforcement. That is, the kind of activity that Dirks did should be encouraged and not discouraged. And so he disagreed with the SEC's conclusion that Dirks should be penalized. And then there was some disagreement between myself and the Solicitor General. The Solicitor General had indicated that he was not going to let the SEC file a brief in this case because he disagreed with his position. And I said that the SEC is an independent agency which has a very strong view about insider trading, and that it ought to be able to present its views to the Supreme Court without the administration stultifying that or preventing that. And I said that if he would not permit it, he has to endorse it. The brief at the bottom saying, I approve the filing of this brief. If he would not do that, the SEC would consider the possibility of filing a brief directly with the Supreme Court. And he said, well, if that would happen, the clerk of the court would not accept it because he would look to see whether I had approved it. He would see no endorsement that approves it. And then said, well, if the clerk would not accept it, we would then consider bringing a common law mandamus petition to the nine justices, which is an old common law writ, it was called, which asks the court to direct a clerk to perform a ministerial act, like accepting a document for filing. That would then raise the question as to whether the SEC, as an independent agency, would have the right to bring its views to the Supreme Court. So on reflection, at some point, Solicitor General Rex Lee decided to let the SEC file a brief. I guess he didn't want to go through that test, and did endorse it. But he endorsed it in a way which made clear his disagreement. And when we filed the brief, the SEC filed the brief, he says on the brief, I authorize the filing of this brief, but see brief for the United States as amicus curiae in support of reversal, filed December 30, 1982. And then he filed a brief on behalf of the United States in which he disagreed with the SEC's view in the Supreme Court. But when the court decided the case, as I say, on this different theory, not on the Solicitor General's theory, which it didn't pay any attention to one way or the other. It's also interesting that when the case came down, just like the Chiarella case has some very good language and concurring opinions about the misappropriation theory, and the old cliche about how the SEC then made lemonade out of lemons, there was a similar thing happening in Dirks. In Dirks, there was a footnote 14. And footnote 14 said that, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, it's kind of long, but it says essentially that under certain circumstances, such as where corporate information is revealed legitimately to an underwriter, accountant, lawyer, or consultant working for the corporation, these outsiders may become fiduciaries of the shareholders. The theory was that they would become what we would call temporary insiders. And then the analysis then would not be that they would be tippies like Dirks was a tippie. They would be tippers. They would be equivalent to corporate officials. So this temporary insider theory, which then lets the SEC now reach underwriters, that is, stockbrokers, accountants, lawyers, and consultants, was a very important breakthrough in a way. Even though the case was lost on the merits largely, this was the SEC thought a very helpful footnote. And I recall that I was doing a lot of lecturing and speaking at that time, and of course including insider trading. So after the case came down, I had a debate before, I think, an American Bar Association group with Milton Freeman. Milton Freeman was a senior partner at Arnold & Porter. Arnold & Porter had David Bonderman from Arnold & Porter had argued the case, and they were very interested in the case. And I remember that I emphasized that footnote 14 was very important to the SEC's enforcement program. And Milton Freeman said that the trouble with SEC lawyers is that they never know when they've lost a case because they always are reading the footnotes instead of the text. Then I had a later debate with him, not too much, maybe a week or two later, before another group also, about the Dirks case, which then was quite fresh. And he referred to the previous statement that he had made about Gonson not knowing that he lost the case because he always reads the footnotes instead of the text. And he says, now, he says, I have documentary evidence. He waves a piece of paper in the air that this is uniform among SEC lawyers. And then he reads a letter from Theodore Levine, Ted Levine, who then was at the SEC, very active in this program. And the letter says something like this, Dear Milt, I received your outline of the Dirks opinion, you know, for use in the program in San Diego, but I looked in the footnotes and I didn't see in the footnote any statement that your firm had represented Dirks. And don't you think it's fair, only fair, that you would say in a footnote that your firm had represented Dirks in the Supreme Court? He says, and I write back to him, I say, Dear Ted, the reason that we didn't put a footnote is because we said so in the text. And if you would have read the text, you would have seen it. Trouble with the SEC lawyers, you never read the text, you're always reading the footnotes. But nonetheless, it was, I thought, a very useful thing.
Did you initiate a process similar to what happened then after Chiarella, where you started looking around for another case that would advance the program?
Well, we did. There was a problem. The answer is yes, and we did bring some cases, and we also eventually, the SEC came out with a rule called Regulation FD, which to some extent dealt with it. But the process was a much longer process than the filing of the Newman case in New York fairly shortly after the Chiarella decision. Because in the Dirks opinion, the court indicated the value that analysts bring to the securities markets. And there got to be quite a discussion at the SEC and some difficulty in conceptualizing ways in which the SEC could bring lawsuits against analysts. Now, the SEC brought endless lawsuits against tippees, and those were not problems. One of the most interesting to me anyway was the case against Paul Thayer. Paul Thayer was, I think, Deputy Secretary of Defense and a very well-known man. And the SEC was investigating him for insider trading. And he had had an affair with a young aerobics instructor. And there was another fellow who was a stockbroker in the case who also was having, I guess, some relationship with another young aerobics instructor. And Thayer apparently had been giving stock tips to his friend, the aerobics instructor, and trying to use the theory of the Dirks benefit to the tipper. We had to formulate in a way that was, I guess, not too salacious what the benefit of Thayer was as a result of, you know, his giving the stock tips to this tippee. So I was involved, I ordinarily was not involved in drafting district court complaints, but I was involved in this case, the request of the then head of enforcement, who's John Fetters, that I would try to, because of my involvement in Dirks, I would try to work on a language that would be felicitous, and I think we came up with something like close personal relationship or something like that, which was the benefit, the Dirks required benefit to the tipper for the information given to the tippee. And in that case, the insider trading case eventually sort of attenuated because during the investigation, Thayer obstructed justice and eventually went to jail, not for insider trading, but for obstruction of justice. This is sort of the early Martha Stewart analog, where Martha Stewart went to jail for obstruction of justice, not for insider trading. But that was an example. There were another example of a very well-known, I guess I shouldn't mention his name, very well-known person on Wall Street, a household name. His wife had gone to a psychiatrist, and the wife was revealing information to the psychiatrist that she had, of course, obtained from her husband. The psychiatrist was then trading,
right.
And the SEC sued the psychiatrist. Taxi drivers, policemen, word processors and law firms, and there were many, many lawsuits were being brought on that theory. All as tippies. But when you came to the analyst community, it was very hard to bring actions against analysts. There were two cases that we did bring, we being the SEC brought. One was a case called Fox Pitt, F-O-X hyphen P-I-T-T, Kelton, K-E-L-T-O-N, Inc. And this was 1996. And this was a stockbroker. And an analyst receives information during an issuer conference call. And he's in a conference room with a speakerphone on, and several other salespersons from Fox Pitt are walking in and out of this room during the time that this conference call is going on. And why the door wasn't bolted shut, we don't know. And then the salespersons then trade in the stock on behalf of the firm's clients before a public disclosure based upon what they overheard as they walked through this conference room. And then a second Fox Pitt analyst who overheard the call himself trades in the account, and then some senior employees trade in personal accounts. And so the SEC didn't charge insider trading there, but it did charge a violation of the Securities Exchange Act that requires broker-dealers to have in place procedures designed to prevent the use of inside information. As I mentioned, there were some statutes that were passed, and one of the statutes requires that broker-dealers have procedures to prevent insider trading. And so the theory here wasn't a 10b-5 fraud theory. The theory was, well, you didn't have procedures in place that worked, brokerage firm, to prevent this insider trading, and that's why the SEC them. Then there was another case after Dirks called 1991 called SEC versus Philip J. Stevens. And in that case, this was in the Southern District of New York, at a much earlier time, Stevens, who was head of this company, had a negative report from an analyst about his company. And several years later, the company realized it was going to have another disappointing quarter. And so what Stevens did before he disclosed this bad information was that he made a series of calls to analysts before he informed the market as a whole, and two of these analysts then tipped their clients who then dumped their shares before the bad news came out. And the benefit that the SEC said that Stevens had obtained by tipping, you have to show a benefit to the tipper, was to protect and enhance his reputation. That is, that he was trying to curry favor with the analysts, and that was his benefit or the benefit of the company. The case was settled, so that theory was never tested in court. So these were the sort of the kinds of cases the SEC brought after Dirks.
You're on your way to O'Hagan.
Well, I think we've got to talk about Carpenter before we go to O'Hagan. There was an effort in the 1980s in Congress to develop a definition of insider trading. This sort of has to do, in a way, with the Dirks case and the Carpenter case. Also with the fact that Boesky was quoted in telling some class that greed was good and greed should be encouraged, and that greatly offended John Dingell, who then was head of the SEC's Oversight Committee in the House. And there were some efforts made, as I said, and over quite a period of time, really, to try to develop some definition of insider trading, statutory definition of insider trading. Well, while this was going on, the SEC, or the Department of Justice with the SEC, brought a criminal case against a reporter for the Wall Street Journal who was named F. Foster Winans, W-I-N-A-N-S. And Winans wrote a column called Heard on the Street, which was sort of a gossip column for companies. And he would write about, you know, companies that seemed to be doing well or companies that weren't seen to be doing well. And the Wall Street Journal has this enormous circulation, of course, around the country. And in fact, many people who read that column will sometimes buy stock of companies that seem that are reported favorably, or sell short companies that are reported unfavorably. So Winans had, with a group of people, including stockbrokers, set up a system where he would leak in advance to these people what he was going to write about in his columns. Then, if he was going to write something good about a company, why, those people then would buy shares in that company. And then after the article came out, why, of course, the buying pressure of the people who read that article would raise the price of the stock, and these people would make a lot of money. So the government eventually brought a criminal case against Winans. Carpenter was Winans' roommate. When the case goes to the Supreme Court, it's called Carpenter, but we always refer to it as the Winans case. And in the district court, Winans gets convicted, and the case goes to the Second Circuit, and the Second Circuit affirms the conviction. The Supreme Court grants certiorari in Winans. However, the case is called Carpenter versus the United States because of the peculiarity in how the Supreme Court captions their cases. Okay. I was saying that the case is captioned Carpenter versus the U.S. in the Supreme Court, and that's because the rules provide that in the lower courts, the person who brings the lawsuit goes first, the plaintiff, right? So it'd be U.S., the United States, versus Winans. And then the rules also say that when the case goes up on appeal, then the Court of Appeals has to keep the same caption that was in the district court. The Supreme Court has its own rules. The Supreme Court says that the party that petitions for review, that person goes first. And so if the government loses, why, it would be United States versus, right? That would seem to make sense. But where the government wins, it's the guy who loses, he goes first. So the case is called Carpenter versus the United States in the Supreme Court. And why the lawyers decided to put Carpenter's name first rather than Winans, is Carpenter et al., which means et alia and others, is beyond me. I don't know. But the case is called Carpenter in the Supreme Court. Carpenter goes up to the Supreme Court, and the issue that's being raised in is that that unlike all these other misappropriation cases, the tipper, or the person disadvantaged, is not in the securities business. I mean, you know, all these other, these were all stockbrokers or other people. He says, this is a newspaper. So why is a theft from a newspaper actionable as a insider trading violation? Also, I think the Reporters Committee for a Free Press came in as in front of the court and said there shouldn't be a conviction here either. And so you got a little bit of a First Amendment overtone, you know, to this case too. However, Carpenter and Wynans and the others were convicted not only of insider trading, they were convicted of mail fraud and wire fraud. And so they appeal both sets of convictions. While the case is pending, the Supreme Court comes out with a mail fraud case called McNally, M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, McNally versus United States, in which they hold, Supreme Court holds, rejects the conviction of that case, says that the theory under which United States attorneys, these are federal officials, proceed against state judges, governors, other officials, for not giving loyal services to their constituents is not reached under the mail fraud statute, which speaks only of money and property. You have to take money or property. And so Governor Marvin Mandel from Maryland, who had earlier been convicted under that mail fraud section, gets out of jail. And a lot of other people do too, as a result of that case. So now this insider trading case becomes a huge, important mail fraud case because it's the next case to go to the Supreme Court on mail fraud after is the court's McNally decision. Later on, I must say that the Congress reversed legislatively the Supreme Court by coming out with a new law called the McNally Act that, in fact, reinstated the law before the McNally decision, but that hadn't happened yet. So this is the next case after McNally. So it becomes sort of an important mail fraud case, too. And, of course, the argument is made both in the securities case and the mail fraud case that this isn't, you know, this isn't property. This is ephemeral in the air. And the Supreme Court splits 4-4 on the securities count and unanimously affirms the mail fraud count, distinguishing McNally. So it's sort of a big win for the government, because it sort of puts the mail fraud program back on track, but it leaves the securities issue of the misappropriation theory up in the air. So under the Supreme Court rule, when the Supreme Court is evenly divided, then whatever the lower court decision was stands, because it's not reversed. So in this case, the lower court had, of course, affirmed the conviction, so the conviction stands. Mail fraud, the securities conviction stands. I mentioned a moment ago that there was this effort on the Hill to try to get a definition, and the Senate was pushing pretty hard on that. Harvey Pitt, Dick Phillips, others were very active in working with the Senate committee, developing it. The SEC generally did not like the idea of a definition at all, because they were doing so well and they didn't want to. They thought definition was going to hamstring them, you know, not help them. But reluctantly, under pressure, when David Ruder was SEC chairman, which would be 1987, 89, in that era, right, the SEC did endorse in a lukewarm way one version of this. But the conventional wisdom around town was that the SEC was going to lose the Wynans case in the Supreme Court. And it was necessary after that loss to resurrect the program by coming out with a definition. But when the court split 4-4 and the SEC did not lose the case, but the Second Circuit was affirmed, then in the House of Representatives, all the starch and steam went out of the idea of a definition, and it never happened. It just fell flat. So to this day, there's still no definition. But that was an interesting period in which that happened. There's also something which, to me, as a litigating lawyer, is just very fascinating in the Wynans case. And that is that when we were doing, I think, the briefing in the O'Hagan case, which I'm going to get to next, we sent a lawyer over to the Library of Congress to look through Justice Marshall's papers. Justice Marshall had died, and he had left his papers to the Library of Congress, but without any restriction on use. And the Supreme Court, particularly at that time, Chief Justice Rehnquist, were somewhat offended because they felt that there should be a long period of time that would elapse between the time that a justice who passes away leaves papers and those papers become then public, because there might still be things in those papers that might apply to current matters. But Justice Marshall had not restricted that in his deed of gift to the Library of Congress. So they worked out something where they allowed scholars to come in and do research. So Adam Pritchard, who was a lawyer at that time in the General Counsel's office, went over to the Library of Congress to rummage through Justice Marshall's papers for no reason at all, just to see if there was something in there that might be useful to us as we were briefing the O'Hagan case. And he comes upon this remarkable document. He comes upon a document where Justice Powell has a draft which he had circulated to other justices on December 10, 1986, dissenting from the denial of certiorari in Carpenter. But in Carpenter, cert was granted, and they took the case. So what does this document mean? Well, Justice Powell's draft dissent was joined the next day on December 11 by Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justice O'Connor. That is, three justices were now dissenting from the denial of cert. But this document was never published, and it was in Marshall's file because Justice Powell has circulated this to all the justices. Justice Brennan and Justice Scalia had switched their votes, and then they voted to grant certiorari. By voting to grant certiorari, this document then never saw the light of day, this proposed dissent from the denial of certiorari. After certiorari is granted, but before the Carpenter case gets argued, Justice Powell retires from the Supreme Court. And his successor, Justice Anthony Kennedy, was not confirmed until after the argument. So there's this hiatus now. There's only eight justices, and Kennedy did not participate in the case. So the court then splits 4-4, and they issue no opinion, and nor do they indicate which justice votes for or votes against. So we don't know how the lineup is. But in O'Hagan, we see later that Justice O'Connor and Kennedy voted with the majority to uphold the misappropriation theory. So if Kennedy had been confirmed in time, and there was nine justices, likely, no one knows for sure, but at least based on his later vote to uphold the misappropriation theory, in O'Hagan, he probably would have voted to uphold it in this case too, in which case there would have been a 5-4 affirmance, and we would have had the law of the land at that point. Now, in Justice Powell's draft dissent, he says, a comparison of the Court of Appeals opinion in this case, referring to the Winans Carpenter case, with our recent precedents, referring to Chiarella and Dirks, demonstrates the need for examination by the court of the misappropriation theory. And then he talks about the Dirks and Chiarella case, and he says, applying these principles to this case, it is difficult to understand how any of the petitioners were guilty of criminal securities fraud. So had he not retired and voted, then there would have been a 5-4 decision overruling the misappropriation theory. And if Kennedy had been seated, there would have been 5-4 approving it. So you see how the vagaries of, you know, who happens to be on the court when it splits, you know, 5-4 often depends on that one swing vote.
So there's a lot of chance here.
There was. Adam Pritchard then wrote a wonderful article about this, which Laurie York was published, and subsequently has written several other articles on Justice Powell's role in the Supreme Court. Well, before we come to O'Hagan, just sort of to finish the Dirks epilogue, the SEC finally in August 2000 adopts Regulation FD, which stands for Fair Disclosure, and that was designed, I guess, in a way, roughly speaking, to legislatively overrule the Dirks decision, which it had all problems with, even though, as I mentioned, the Stevens and Fox-Kelton cases, it had a lot of difficulty in bringing cases against analysts. So when you had corporate insiders whisper in the ears of analysts before that information became public, the SEC decided by rule to pass a rule to deal with that. When I was at the SEC in my sort of last year there, I started to work a little bit on this rule, and it was a rule that was based on 10b-5. It was going to be a particularized 10b-5 rule. But after I left, the thinking obviously switched, and they adopted the rule not under Section 10b, which applies to any person in any security, but they adopted it under Section 13 of the Exchange Act, which is the act that deals with filing reports with the SEC. So that the reach of the rule isn't any person, any security, like the insider trading is based on 10b. Rather, it applies only to issuers with securities that are registered and or who have to file reports with the SEC. And what it does, I'm not going to go through the detail, but essentially it sets up a system where if an issuer is going to give non-public material information about the company, then it has to also simultaneously find a way to issue that to the stock market.
Right.
In a sense, that's what it does. And there are some other aspects of the rule which would be very interesting, but that was a way in which the SEC was then dealing with the long-term fallout. After all, Dirks was 83 and this rule is 2000, so it took a long, long period of time for the SEC to get its act together. One other thing I may mention, too, was there was an episode where there was a big fight with the IRS that I was involved in. The SEC was grabbing the profits from insider trading to try to get them back to the investors who were defrauded. And the IRS was trying to grab these profits for unpaid taxes, penalties, and interest. And, of course, guys like Dennis Levine didn't pay taxes. I think Boesky did. Some did, some did not. And the SEC, of course, negotiated with the IRS, the Justice Department, at great length to try to work out an arrangement, not with much success, and there was some litigation in court between the two agencies, and there was a case in the Second Circuit that I was going to argue. I showed up New York, Second Circuit, ready to argue against the IRS. The IRS lawyer was there. And the presiding judge, a three-judge panel, said, "Is this true? My eyes deceive me? We have two agencies of the federal government are arguing and they want the court to decide this?" He says, "You two guys go out in the lawyer's lounge and settle this case." He said, "You come back here after, you know, we have heard all the arguments this morning and tell us if you settled it and how you settled it." So we go back, you know, and I call back and he calls back to Washington and we settle it. But there was this tiff that went on for a while. I wrote a larger article about that. Hmm. Interesting.
Why did you get to that point?
Well, I don't know. I'm involved in current cases where I don't want to disclose what I'm doing, but there are, you know, interagency disagreements about things, and the IRS felt that, yeah, the law is pretty clear, the IRS thought that whether the income is legal or illegally earned, it's still income. You have to pay taxes on it. And if you didn't pay taxes on it, then, of course, interest runs on the unpaid taxes. And if you intentionally didn't do it, why, penalties run too. So when you start adding the penalties and the interest, you, over a period of time, you pretty much consume the whole thing. The SEC, meanwhile, is trying to give the money back to victims. That's the whole theory of disgorgement, is you get the money back and you try to give it to victims. And so you had two agencies, you know, blue chip agencies, really, with different theories. Each one made sense, I guess, to each other. And They were trying to work out an accommodation, which took quite a while to do.
You just needed some judges to help you.
You needed some judges to say, okay, go in the back room and settle this thing.
Well, let's get to the O'Hagan case then.
Okay. Now, O'Hagan, I mentioned to you that the Second Circuit, the Seventh Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit had all found that the misappropriation theory was valid. A number of circuits had also upheld 14E3 against challenge as well. This was the insider trading rule and tender offers I mentioned. But there came a time when the Fourth Circuit in Richmond, that the appeals court for the Mid-Atlantic states, disagreed with the misappropriation theory. This involved the West Virginia lottery. The fellow who was running the West Virginia lottery was supposed to select a company to run the lottery for the state, and he knew which company was going to be selected. So he bought stock in that company before the award was given, and then was prosecuted by federal authorities, both under mail fraud and under securities fraud. It's a puzzle to me why they had to add securities fraud, but they did. They brought that. He gets convicted. The case goes to the Fourth Circuit. The Fourth Circuit affirms the mail fraud, but reverses on the securities fraud, rejecting, in a very lengthy scholarly opinion, the misappropriation theory. So the SEC then says to itself, well, should we appeal this or should we not appeal it? We now have a conflict in circuits, which is one of the bases upon which the Supreme Court will accept a case. But the facts weren't really too good, and in that case there was, as in Newman I mentioned earlier, also a conviction for mail fraud, which was sustained. So the guy's going to go to jail anyway. And so we decided, we being the SEC and the Justice Department, not to seek Supreme Court review in that case. Later, in O'Hagan, it happens again. The Eighth Circuit, which is in St. Louis, also rejects the misappropriation theory. Now we have two cases. So we have a split of three that have accepted and two that have rejected that theory. O'Hagan was a fascinating case. O'Hagan was a lawyer in the very well-known Minneapolis firm of Dorsey and Whitney. And O'Hagan was a securities lawyer. He had himself litigated 10b-5 cases, certainly knew securities law. And at that time, Dorsey and Whitney was representing a company named Grand Met, which was secretly preparing to make a tender offer bid for a local company, Pillsbury. And this was kept secret, of course. O'Hagan was not working on this case, on this matter. But he was a very senior partner in the firm, and he was nosing around, and he went to the lawyer who was working on it, and he got a lot of information about this upcoming tender offer. And then he took that information, and he bought stock and options on stock in Pillsbury. And when the tender offer was announced, he made $4 million, a lot of money. It also came out that he had been taking clients' funds. And he was the heir to Justice Blackmun. When Justice Blackmun was at Dorsey & Whitney, the Mayo Clinic was Blackmun's client. And now the Mayo Clinic was O'Hagan's client. And O'Hagan was taking money from the Mayo Clinic. It was just a very, very bad scene. So O'Hagan gets disbarred, and he gets prosecuted criminally by the federal authorities for insider trading. And he gets convicted. His case goes to the Eighth Circuit. The Eighth Circuit reverses the conviction. They say, well, they don't approve of his conduct, obviously. But they make an analysis, and they don't think the misappropriation theory is sound. They also reject as invalid Rule 14E3, which is he was also charged under that because there was a tender offer, and of course he was violating the rule that says you can't use insider information on a tender offer. He had obtained the information from a source connected, of course, with the bidder, which is the law firm. The case goes to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court reverses the Eighth Circuit and reinstates the conviction and upholds the misappropriation theory in a very strong opinion. It also upholds the validity of Rule 14e3 in a strong opinion. So it becomes a very big win for the government to finally get, after Carpenter refused to reach it, and Congress didn't ever approve it legislatively, finally, the Supreme Court in the O'Hagan case affirms the misappropriation theory. It was a case with good facts. It was interesting that I second-chaired it, as we say. The case was argued by the, what we call the criminal deputy, Michael Dreeben, D-R-E-E-B-E-N. Criminal deputy doesn't mean he's a criminal. It means he's the deputy solicitor general who handles the criminal cases. And he argued the case. He's an old friend of mine, and we had many cases together over the years in the Supreme Court. And so I sat with him at counsel table. We had prepared the case elaborately. We had two moot courts. You know, moot court is where he gives his argument and you ask a million questions. And three conferences that were not moot courts, and many, many late night phone calls before the oral argument. We tried to anticipate every and any question that might be asked by a justice during the argument. We also tried to circumscribe or delimit or put a fence around the scope of the argument is to not make it too broad, because if you make it too broad, it's hard to sell. And we were delighted that after the argument was over, he argues, because he lost, so the government argues first, and the O'Hagan's lawyer argues, and then he has rebuttal. He asked me, what should I say in rebuttal? And the answer was, I don't think you have to say anything, because there wasn't one question that was asked that he had not, or we had not rehearsed the answer to. So when you read the transcript of the oral argument, while it's mostly question and answers, and every justice except Justice Thomas asked a question, so eight justices asked questions in that case, the oral argument reads seamlessly as if he's anticipating these questions, and it doesn't read in a disjointed way, you know, question answer. It reads like a coherent argument, which he had would go back to and go back to and go back to, interweaving answers to his questions into this argument. It's a brilliant argument.
When you're doing something like that, do you think, well, Justice so-and-so is going to say, might ask something like this?
Yes, indeed we do. We thought we knew what Justice Scalia was going to ask. We thought we knew what Justice O'Connor was going to ask. And we were pretty dead right. We knew what Justice, we thought we knew what Chief Justice Rehnquist was going to ask. And I can't say we got it all right, but we anticipated many of those questions based upon their previous decisions and based upon generally the fact that if you read Supreme Court decisions, you see a certain trend lines and how these justices vote. We were surprised that the case was 6-3 in favor of the misappropriation theory, and Chief Justice Rehnquist, Justice Thomas, and Justice Scalia dissented. But Justice Scalia's dissent refers to a doctrine in the criminal law called the doctrine of lenity, L-E-N-I-T-Y, that says that if you have a close question in a criminal case, you give the benefit of that doubt to the criminal defendant. And this is a criminal case. And he seemed to be saying, we think, that if this had been a civil case brought by the SEC rather than a criminal case brought by the Department of Justice, probably would have gone along with it. So while it doesn't make any difference because the court, in a very strong majority opinion, upholds the theory, it adds a little gloss to it because even conservative Justice Scalia is signaling that in civil SEC cases under that theory, probably he would go along with it too. He also went along with the validity of Rule 14e3. That was 7-2, with Scalia then in the majority agreeing on the validity of the rule. So that was a pretty, very important win for the SEC because that, as I mentioned, was the theory upon which these big blockbuster cases in the 80s were brought. And if that theory had been undermined by the Supreme Court, then I think the SEC would have had to go to Congress and get a definition, because then they would have had no real alternative but to do
right.
that. But didn't have to do that, so today we're still in the as I said when we started, if you look in the law, you will find no definition of insider trading and nothing that makes it unlawful. You just have to read the cases.
But those who want to prosecute are on much more solid ground than they want.
Yes, they are. And I have to say for the SEC, you know, I joke now, I've been at this law firm 7.5 years, that I tell everybody that I used to, for many years, prosecute stockbrokers, now I defend them. Still, I have to say that the SEC has had a very formidable and successful insider trading program. I might also devote just 1 minute, I know they're running a little long, on the civil private side. There is also a private analog where private investors can bring lawsuits to recover damages insider trading. There's a specific section of one of the Insider Trading Sanctions Act that permits that, but limits the recovery to the disgorgement measure, which means that the injured investor can only recover that amount which the insider trader gained, which might be less than his total amount of damages. So in general, while that private lawsuit is permitted specifically, it's not the best kind of lawsuit because of the limitation. No, it's a limitation on the amount of recovery. So anyway, that's
anything else we haven't talked about?
Well, I guess to say that so far now I'm on the outside looking in, and so far as I can tell, the SEC still continues a pretty vigorous insider trading program. I might observe, as an old-timer, having lived through this program, particularly in the late 70s and 80s, that it recycles again. So maybe it's part of the larger lesson of life that younger people don't learn from, you know, the abuses of their elders.
Yeah.
But the same kinds of improprieties that got young investment bankers and other people on Wall Street into trouble are getting them again into trouble. And the SEC is cracking down again the same way it did 20, 25 years ago. And so one wonders why people won't learn from the problems that their fathers and others had.
Yeah. Well, human nature being what it is, I guess there ought to be the need for that.
I guess that's right.
Well, thanks very much.
Well, thank you, Ken. I enjoyed it.